Hello and welcome to Meet the Education Researcher. This is a podcast from the Faculty of Education, Monash University in Melbourne, Australia.
Hello and welcome back. My name is Neil Sowen from Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, and today we're talking about academics' working relationships with digital technologies such as social media and generative AI. To do this, I'm joined by Mark Carrigan from the University of Manchester. Mark has long been one of the most interesting thinkers around the topic of scholarship in the digital age. His 2016 Social Media for Academics book with Sage has been revised into a second edition, and towards the middle of 2024, we'll see another new book titled Generative AI for Academics. So Mark is the ideal person to get advice from on how to navigate the murky worlds of X, Mastodon, Blue Sky, ChatGPT and Bard. But before we got into the weeds of the AI and social media tools of 2024, I asked Mark to look back to the simpler times of the 2010s. What prompted him to get so heavily into academic social media use to the extent of writing a handbook on the topic?
And it felt to me partly as someone who'd been blogging for a very long time. I started blogging 21 years ago now. And possibly because I'm someone who spent a lot of time on forums when I was younger as well, there's a certain kind of textual engagement online, which I just immediately understood how to do. And as someone who was using social media to try and stitch together a precarious research career alongside other commitments, I think that gave me a perspective on how you could use it as a space for thinking with other people under often quite difficult material circumstances. And so I wanted to capture some of that to just walk people through how to find a way of using social media that was a good fit for them. The theoretical side of my work is about reflexivity in the critical realist tradition. And so I didn't bring that into the book, but in essence, I was trying to guide people in how to do reflexive decision-making about social media in a straightforward way. And so I was trying through a focus on different areas of practice. So public engagement, networking, publicizing your work, just to walk people through that process and with the intention of making it a more accessible space. So that initial anxiety and uncertainty, what should I tweet about? What happens if someone dislikes something I've shared online? Just to kind of help people get through that stage to try and settle on a kind of modus vivendi, a way of working with social media that was right for them.
And it should have been a reflexive, as you said, differentiated decision that could have taken us 100 different ways. I guess at the beginning of 2010s and onwards, a lot of us got sucked into the one platform, got sucked onto Twitter. Academic Twitter seemed to be the place to be. And looking back, I mean, now that it's kind of no more, what did you make of Twitter as a platform, as a community for academics and researchers to, as you say, think out loud and work with each other? How significant was it and what did it do for us?
I think it did a lot, but I think its eventual downfall was there from the start. And it's striking when I've looked through the first edition of that social media book, how much Twitter dominates it in a way that I now quite regret. And that was because for me, it was a hugely liberating space. I mean, it was a space of professional identity. It was a space of public identity. And particularly if at an early stage in your career, you're juggling multiple hats, to have that unified identity can be very empowering. And I don't think I was the only person who had that experience of Twitter being a place where different threads of professional identities could come together. And partly that reflects the experience, but not the reality, that this was a gathering space. This was where all the academics were. And clearly that wasn't the case. It's never been the case. But it felt like that. I think it was an interesting trick of the platform logic to create a sense of this being the place. And I think that was deliberately contrived by the platform operators. And what made it special, I think, was the brevity of the exchange. The culture began to change when it went from 140 characters to 280 characters. The sequential timeline was very important as well, because it meant you were existing within an information ecosystem defined entirely by your own choices, or nearly entirely by your own choices. And the relatively unstructured and open nature of it at that time, when no one really knew what it was for, and it was thriving on that. In academia, I think that was there's something very energizing about that mix of control, unpredictability, and openness. But when it moved from, as I've said, 140 to 280 characters, and it began to move towards an algorithmic timeline. And in other parts of my work, I've looked at how it was incorporated into research assessment in the UK. So when people began to see it as a proxy for impact capacity, and it began to be tacitly, sometimes explicitly expected by employers, I think that changed the culture as well. That sense of playfulness began to be squeezed out because it came to feel like something, at least in some university systems, you kind of had to do, or be at risk of being left behind. And the level of insecurity and anxiety amongst early career researchers, understandably given the job market, compounded that. So I think it was an interesting mix at first, and over time it began to unravel, which is very unfortunate. The side of it that I think is really sad is how effective it was for public engagement. So in those early years of Twitter, when academic Twitter kind of butted up against policy Twitter, media Twitter, you were able to, in my experience, get into conversations with, say, journalists or media researchers that led to public engagement pretty much organically, which is quite a remarkable thing. You know, you're chatting to your academic friends about a piece of research, and then suddenly you're talking to a journalist who says, this is really interesting. You know, could we have a call? And I think that's gone as well now. So I'm sad about it. I think there was something very special about it, but it was always very fragile. And the incentives of platform capitalism meant that the firm was always going to impose algorithmic filtering on it. It was always going to incentivize certain kinds of behavior. And it was always going to end up this way, I think, in retrospect.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the logic, the platform logics, and that also kind of taps into something else that you're quite well known for writing about, the idea of the platform university, for example. And in some ways, Twitter was a sort of stealth way that a lot of academics were plugged into what you could call the platform university.
Yeah, so the platform university is a phrase that's been used in slightly different ways by people. I've tended to think of it as a kind of speculative object of what a comprehensively platformized university would look like. So when platform structures are imposed as intermediaries into every aspect of the organization. And initially, I saw this as speculative, but actually during the pandemic, we saw an actual platform university where there was a bare bones physical infrastructure and a skeleton staff maintaining it. But other than that, everything was platformized. And so, yeah, I think it's good to think of Twitter as a stealth mechanism through which that was introduced. And it normalized the experience of working with platforms, of thinking in terms of platform incentives. A practical example that I pointed to earlier is research assessment. And when you have to tell a story about how your research is having an impact, you draw on social media metrics to do that. And when you have to plan how to have an impact, you look to social media to do it. And I find this really interesting sociologically because it suggests that the logic of social media has now been folded into the logic of research evaluation. There's a kind of loose coupling there, which I think this is a very obvious example of it. But I suspect we could find comparable examples elsewhere.
And also there are platforms that now universities are investing in to give them things like altmetrics to feed the kind of data back to them. So it becomes this kind of recursive loop, which is fascinating. Now, I mean, in some ways, as you say, Twitter and X have kind of died a death. What do you make to the almost quite sad sight of a lot of academics scrambling around to find some sort of replacement? So people are going off to Mastodon or people are going off to Blue Sky, all over the place.
That's a very good way of describing it. And there is something sad about that site. I've read a lot of psychoanalysis over the last couple of years, and that kind of desperate search for the lost object, the object that when you had it, it really wasn't that great. But once you've not got it anymore, you desperately want it back. And seeing that play out communally is really interesting. Because of what I study, I wanted to give Blue Sky a proper go. And so really commit myself to understanding what it's like to be a user of Blue Sky. And the conclusion I reached after 2 months of using it near daily was that it's Twitter from the early 2010s.
Yeah.
And you look at the history of Blue Sky, and it was designed to be that. I mean, the decentralized protocol does not yet have much impact on how it operates in practice. And I think in the future, the impact of that decentralization will play out at the level of service provision. And otherwise, it's basically just old Twitter. And I used it for 2 months, thought, this is nice. And then, oh, this is why I stopped using Twitter in the first place. And I haven't gone back to Blue Sky since December. Mastodon, I think, is a different kettle of fish in many ways because it is designed not to scale. It's designed not to produce the cultural pathologies that Twitter gave rise to, not to encourage people to chase influence, to chase impact in the same way. It's designed to facilitate meaningful, high-quality conversation. And that, I think, is great. But academics, I worry, have been socialized into the lore of virality over the 2010s. And the buzz you're talking about, academics just won't get it off Mastodon.
No.
And they're not going to embrace it for that reason. The one I've still used most, which I'm amazed to find myself saying this, is LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Possibly the digital education community. So it's a great way for people in the field to have a dialogue with practitioners. But it just doesn't have that kind of slightly addictive kick that other platforms have. It's very effective as a mechanism for sharing things you're doing, hearing what other people are doing, and talking about it. But whereas as a long-term user of Twitter, I found myself after posting a tweet, you know, that kind of fidgety, I wonder if anyone's replied yet. Maybe I should log in and see if like people are talking about it. When I post on LinkedIn, I can't imagine ever thinking about it again.
No.
You know, I forget things I posted. It's a purely practical social media. And I often think back to a remark Mark Fisher made towards the end of his life of how we could learn to use social media rather than live in it. And I find it very easy to use LinkedIn. And I could never imagine myself living in LinkedIn. Whereas I did live in Twitter for the 2010s.
I feel shameful just even using LinkedIn because for a long time, I was highly suspicious of anyone that was on LinkedIn as being some kind of corporate sellout. And now here we all are on LinkedIn trying to desperately, as you say, at least try and push our stuff to other people. So, I mean, in some ways, social media is dead. But of course, you know, if 2023 was the death knell for all of social media, it was also the rise of generative AI, which is what your new book is going to be about. Generative AI now is becoming part of academic knowledge production, I guess. And you're writing really interesting stuff about this. And on one hand, you argue that actually generative AI can be a force for good in scholarship. It can enrich our scholarship.
Yeah, so I think it can do that. I think it probably won't. And the book is an effort to try and make an argument about what a intellectual culture of using generative AI would look like. And it's a guide to how to use it in a way that enriches your scholarship, which I would argue rests on having a kind of relationship of interlocution towards these systems. So my concern is that people instinctively relate to conversational agents like ChatGPT and Claude as assistants, effectively, who they outsource tasks to. So you will not want to do something yourself, and instead you give a sentence or two of instruction to Claude and tell Claude to do it for you. This is problematic, in my view, firstly, because if you approach it in this way, as a manner purely of saving time, you're not going to prompt the system effectively. You know, I think claims made about prompt engineering are terribly overhyped and there's a lot of bullshit surrounding it. But you do need to learn to talk to these systems. You need to learn to establish expectations. You need to learn to evaluate and give feedback. And if you imagine you can just give singular instructions briefly and straightforwardly and then get a significant result from the systems, you're going to be disappointed. And I think a lot of academics who suggest this is all hype, and clearly there is a lot of hype surrounding it, but the idea it's all hype rests, I suspect, on people who haven't learned to prompt them effectively. And the argument I'm making is that you need to have a kind of dialogical approach. You need to talk to these systems about what you're doing and why. And you can ask them to do stuff for you, certainly, but that has to be embedded within a conversation. The breakthrough in my own use of it was realizing I had the mental model of a tweet. So initially, I was imagining that I was giving instructions in tweets to these systems. And then I started writing much longer prompts and discovering that actually, I think the best mental model is a blog post. And I've spent the last year and a half blogging at these systems to see what happens and being increasingly amazed by the quality of what can be produced. It's uneven. Sometimes they will fall down in unpredictable ways and you can't fully rely on them. But you can have a meaningful intellectual dialogue with them. And what I've argued in the book is that the labor of extensive prompting, which can be very off-putting to academics, is actually self-clarification. You know, it's the same argument I've made about blogging for academics, that the act of writing something long form without a particular instrumental outcome in mind, it helps you understand what you think. You know, to understand what you're asking the system to do, you have to understand what you want to do. And so I've drawn a parallel to rubber ducking as a development practice. So when developers are stuck on a problem, they'll have a rubber duck on their computer monitor. And the programming practice is to explain the problem to the rubber duck. You talk out loud, and the very act of explaining the problem can help you understand what you're trying to do. And I'm suggesting we can relate to something like Claude as a rubber duck that talks back to us. And so I'm arguing it's much more similar to the intellectual benefits academics got from blogging and Twitter than it is to, say, having a research assistant who, you know, will do part of your tasks for you that you don't want to do. It can save you time, but if you approach it through the lens of time saving, you're going to get poor quality results. And the really reliable ways in which it can save you time will be hard to get to. There's a lot of startup costs. You know, you have to learn how to relate to these systems. And crucially, you need to define your own templates as well. You need to define particular kinds of outputs you want from them. And that is a intensive process. But it can enrich your scholarship. And that's been my experience. You know, the book itself is one I talked. There's no text from generative AI that appears anywhere in the book. But the book was a product of a conversation with generative AI about generative AI. And throughout the book, I try and document how I've used generative AI in the course of writing the book. So it became very recursive, but it's also the fastest book I've ever written. Not because I was substituting my own text for the system's text, but because the ideas were continually in motion. I normally have a kind of binge writer's, you know, intense writing for a few days, nothing for 2 weeks. And I was able to keep a kind of consistent level of output on this project, because I was having really enriching conversations with the systems I'm writing about.
Which is all fascinating, as you say, it goes back to kind of psychoanalysis. But you're also talking, if you engage thoughtfully and in long form, then you get thoughtful long form output in response, which is really. But it's also interesting you said you wrote the book really quickly, because, I mean, on the flip side, you do talk about some of the dangers or terrifying implications of all of this, one of which is the what you call the ceaseless acceleration of academic writing. So are you going to be writing brilliant books, but, you know, 10 a year?
I realize there's a tension here, and there are some awkwardly introspective parts of the book that the publisher encouraged me to prune because they were more interesting to my conscience than to any reader, about navigating that tension. The bulk of the book I wrote in about 4 months last summer. The subsequent writing process was mostly about adapting the book to take account of the developments taking place, which has been a very frustrating process. You know, it literally changes week on week. And obviously, I built the book around principles. So the idea is that it's future-proof to some extent because it's principles for using generative AI. But still, there were factual claims in the book that I've had to go back and edit just because they were no longer true. But in terms of your broader point, yeah, that really concerns me. And I became more concerned after writing the book in this way, because of my own experience of how it could turbocharge your productivity, so to speak. And I come to this as someone who, in the 2010s, I ran a research network with my friend Philip Bostal on the Accelerated Academy. And I've been very interested in how we look at higher education and scholarship through the lens of the sociology of time. And the pressures within academic life that have already led to an acceleration of output. You throw generative AI as a set of productivity tools into that mix, and I think we're going to have a real problem very soon if we're not careful. And in writing the book, I'm trying to draw attention to that problem and argue that we have to see this through we have to find a way of combining the lens of individual practice and individual scholarship with a collective responsibility about the unintended consequences of it. It seems clear to me in the higher education standpoint, the problem is higher education. The problem is universities. You know, it's the incentive structure of existing universities that are going to create the real and immediate problem. And in a similar way, I think part of the issue of the technology itself is more to do with the incentives of late capitalism than it is the inherent character of the technology. And to me, it feels important that we recognize that and to think about the implications of that, because I would see it as in part shining a lens on our existing social arrangements. Just as, you know, the assessment panic, we rapidly realized that actually our assessment system wasn't very good to begin with. You know, there were huge gaping holes in this from the start. And I think it can also shine a light on other kinds of social relations.
Absolutely. I mean, as you say, the assessment panic also shone a light on the lack of trust that there is within universities, both from tutors to students, but also the institution to the individual. It certainly was more than just the technology. Putting the two together, though, we do engage with a lot of different social media now. We've got all sorts of generative AI and other forms of AI. It does mean that we're kind of dealing with a very different landscape in the mid-2020s than you and I were 21 years ago. And increasingly automated as well. And I'm just interested about your thoughts around, again, what you call the automated future of research communication. In some ways, as you say, automation is not something to be super critical of. We can talk about working with, working alongside, working around. But I mean, how do you see this automation of research and knowledge production panning out?
Well, this is the tension at the heart of the book, because when I see this through the lens of creative practice, you know, in terms of my career, I'm one half applied technologist, one half sociologist. And the applied technologist is incredibly excited about this stuff. The sociologist thinks it's going to be an absolute disaster because it is a matter of the unintended consequences. And so research communication is a standpoint. You know, you think about scholarly publishing. You know, we already have a crisis of review in scholarly publishing. We have a literature that the rate of growth is slowing in the Anglosphere, which is interesting. But globally, scholarly outputs are still growing at a terrifying rate. And, you know, everyone knows that journals are struggling. And if we see a 10% increase year on year in the rate of publication driven by academics using these tools to do more, what are journals going to do? The obvious thing they're going to do is start to rely on AI to triage submissions. And as people begin to rely on AI readers to make this huge literature tractable, relying on summaries, on kind of cross-analysis of them through automated systems, I don't think it's science fiction to imagine in a few years we could be in a scenario where people are writing papers with AI, journals are triaging and reviewing papers with AI, so papers are then published, which people read with AI systems so they can more efficiently write their own ones. And it's that loop of automation, I think. I've been working with Mark Andreevich's work recently here to try and think about how that could become self-propelling with time. And my real fear is that we could have those sorts of automation loops happening all over the place. But if we see an increase in the production of online content, say if journals started automatically producing a blog post summary of every new paper, we're going to have a glut of content really, really quickly. And I think we could see these competitive cycles across all aspects of academic life. In fact, interestingly, I think we can see them wherever there are platforms. And there's a lot of very complex conceptual and empirical questions that need to be answered about the relationship between platformization and generative AI as a kind of service structure that sits on top of that. But in general, I think it will lead to chaos, and we'll turn to AI in order to manage that chaos.
There'll be a technical fix for the technical problem. So, I mean, thinking positively or hopefully, what preferable scenarios might there be? Automatically, you're thinking about how do we slow things down? How do we scale things down? How do we think otherwise? And again, I guess you're thinking, you write a lot about public pedagogies, for example, or, you know, collective approaches. Where's your mind going in terms of how we might avoid this chaos?
I think we urgently need to develop professional norms and standards around the use of these systems. And we need to have a facility for conversation about that so we can begin to derive professional standards about what is an appropriate and inappropriate scholarly use of these technologies. So public pedagogies is an idea from Nancy Baim and Jean Burgess about how social media facilitates user cultures which reflect on the use of a platform. So, you know, the example they cite in their great biography of Twitter is how people started to talk about practices like the retweet and how those practices were institutionalized by users before they were actually incorporated into the infrastructure of the platform. And this is an idea I found very helpful for thinking about my work as a social media trainer and strategist for how to facilitate conversations within academia about how this should be used and how it shouldn't be used. The problem is that social media as a infrastructure for public pedagogy is breaking down at exactly the moment I think we really need it, which places a greater burden on universities to facilitate these conversations. But the pivot away from essays and the attempt to kind of prop up the assessment system takes up so much institutional energy that universities can't do this either. And so I worry there's not really any space beyond perhaps learned societies and professional associations where these conversations can take place. But I think if they don't take place, it will remain at the level of individual decision making. And if it remains at the level of individual decision making, the tendency over time will be for people to do things that make their life easier in the short term, even if there are unintended consequences. And that's what really worries me about how we could have this kind of very chaotic, individualized uptake of generative AI within the academy. And past a certain point, it's going to be hard to roll that back.
And so, I mean, there's all sorts to think about there, but the way that the technologies actually kind of privilege individualized activity and individualized practice, you know, it's something that you do on your own. You don't talk to other people about how you use ChatGPT. Why would you? We need to kind of normalize, as you say, this is more collect, just having a conversation and being more transparent and working out why we do what we do and how we might do it. Yeah, is really, really interesting. And the key question, as you've just pointed out there, is who does it fall to? And I think, as you say, it's up to us as communities of scholars to try and work this out, because there are some, as you say, there are some really rich benefits that we can have from it. It's actually, I'm quite cynical about most things. It's been really interesting listening to you talk, particularly about generative AI. It has made me think definitely about what I might get from using it in the future. So I'm sure the book is going to be fascinating. So thanks ever so much for taking the time, Mark. It's really, genuinely, really interesting. And yeah, I look forward to the next 10 books.
Yeah, thank you. This was a really good conversation.